From the creative team that brings you the world and everything in it, this is a World Radio Special Report. Today, the first in a three-part series titled Safe Delivery. The subject matter may not be appropriate for all ages. Here's your host, Myrna Brown.
It's been 8 months since the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in its Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision. Now, states are choosing to either embrace abortion or protect life. And for pro-lifers trying to reach mothers in crisis, the battle lines are shifting.
We were finding babies at the doors of safe haven locations. Now, why would a mother go all the way to the hospital and leave her baby at the door?
I don't think that message that I'm giving gets told. And when it does, it causes people to start to think, what is the real best response of the pro-life community, especially in a post-Roe v. Wade world?
If we can address the crisis that they're in, we have found that the baby's often not the crisis. Their life is the crisis.
Maybe there will be a greater need for people looking to the safe haven laws as a legal alternative to deal with a baby that a parent feels they cannot keep.
For decades, safe haven laws have been a steady, if uncelebrated, tool in the pro-life movement. But they could soon get a lot more use. In this podcast, we'll meet those working on the front lines and learn how they are saving mothers and babies in crisis.
In a quarter mile, turn left onto East Windsor Avenue.
It's a little after 7 p.m. Driving semi-frantically down palm tree-lined streets, I listen with one ear to my navigation while keeping both eyes peeled for a slender blonde, wearing a white t-shirt, black sweats, and a pinned-up ponytail. I see her, standing in an empty parking lot next to a gray Jeep.
Bless your heart, you found it.
Oh boy, thank you for meeting me.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry to make it complicated.
Heather Berner and I were supposed to meet at her home office, a 30-minute drive from Phoenix. Instead, and I would also add providentially, we were sitting elbow to elbow facing a hospital entrance. Slightly scrunched, we settled in the front seats of my compact-sized rental for a 40-minute conversation.
So let's just start there. Mm-hmm. Why am I interviewing you in my car?
Because of the nature of what we do, we operate a 24-hour hotline nationally and here in Arizona. And so occasionally there are times where a mother is in need of help and boots on the ground assistance. And so that's what I was today. And
Berner says the young woman on the other end of this morning's hotline call was experiencing pregnancy denial syndrome.
She knew she was pregnant from about 8 weeks, but did not address the pregnancy in any way and get any type of support or doctor visits. I mean, she had zero interaction in regards to her pregnancy. So wanted to make sure that she did not deliver her baby alone at home.
Berner also wanted to be sure the baby wasn't at risk for abandonment.
A shocking find.
A heartbreaking discovery.
Tonight's big story.
A newborn baby girl, less than 1 hour old.
A baby just hours old.
A tiny body underneath a mobile home.
Left on a woman's doorstep.
Abandoned and alone, wrapped in a blanket.
Dead inside a bag.
Uncovered and alone, struggling to breathe.
Umbilical cord still attached, found abandoned, covered in bugs.
Unfortunately, in Arizona, we've had three abandonments this year. Two of which did not survive. One was found in an alley, one was found in a McDonald's, and then one, a parent, placed the baby on a doorstep and rang a doorbell. And praise the Lord that someone answered the door, and that baby was safe. But
over the last 25 years, mothers in the United States have abandoned more than 1,600 babies. More than half have been found dead. But nearly 4,700 babies survived because their parents surrendered them under state safe haven laws.
The public message in English and in Spanish is don't abandon your baby. The public education campaign is to try to stop the alarming number of baby abandonments in Harris County.
Texas became the first state to pass a safe haven law in 1999. The Texas law says any parent can bring his or her baby less than 60 days old to a hospital, fire station, or EMS station, no questions asked. If the baby is unharmed, Parents face no criminal charges, and the Department of Family and Protective Services takes custody. Berner says it took less than 10 years before every state in the nation had its own law.
The law is actually different in every state. So the basis is the same, that a parent can surrender their unharmed infant to a designated provider. The age limit and the providers are different. Hospitals are a provider in every state.
But more work was needed to make sure the Safe Haven law was more than just a list of do's and don'ts. A group of law enforcement, healthcare, and child advocacy leaders took on the challenge.
They just had a lot of emotions about babies being found in dumpsters, and so they started to have the discussions with legislators. Like, what does this look like? How could we provide a safe option for people that are finding themselves in these critical situations, and how can we stop finding babies in dumpsters?
So, in 2004, that group formed the National Safe Haven Alliance, also known as the NSHA. The nonprofit began providing oversight and support to safe haven providers in each state around the country. Heather Berner runs the NSHA, headquartered in Arizona. She has staff across the country.
And we have state representatives in, I think, 10 or 11 of the states that are our kind of boots on the ground folks, too.
Through the NSHA, safe haven providers receive free safe haven training and resources. But Berner says the resource that makes the biggest difference in the lives of mothers in crisis is the 24/7 hotline.
So there's a staff of four of us that are actually on call, and I'm included in that. So
Berner was on call the day of our interview.
So when she called us, it was already a critical time because she was getting ready to deliver her baby. And so we kind of went into action. And at that point, initially, because of her request for safe haven, we really wanted to explore what that looks like. And
Berner says when serving mothers in crisis, she makes sure they understand what their state's safe haven law allows.
Here in Arizona, the safe haven law allows a parent or designated agent to surrender their unharmed infant up to 30 days old to a designated safe haven provider, which includes a hospital, fire station, adoption agencies, churches.
She also reminds them that safe haven should always be a woman's last resort.
When we say, what prevents you from parenting your child? And they'll be sitting outside of an emergency room, much like we are, but they're homeless and they don't have any support system. They don't have any resources. They don't have any coping mechanisms. So at that point, if we can address the crisis that they're in, we have found that the baby's often not the crisis. Their life is the crisis. Have they been trafficked? Have they been assaulted?
Once those mothers are safe and out of danger, the NSHA steps in. Women who choose to raise their babies get resources like counseling, diapers, baby clothing, and gift cards. And if the mother is out of state, Berner says her team will connect her with local organizations also providing basic needs. But if the mother isn't able to raise the baby, Berner says she has other options.
Maybe we can keep their family together. Maybe we can then discuss temporary placement or adoption or what that might look like.
The young woman Berner counseled today chose to keep her baby. Berner believes it's because the baby's father got involved.
She is now delivering and she has her boyfriend with her.
Yeah, he's on his way. Yep, he should be here anytime. So I was able to go.
Would you say what happened today with the young lady, mm-hmm. was that a success?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because, I don't know all of the factors that are going into her situation, but she could have certainly not picked up the phone and made a different choice.
In 2010, before Berner became executive director of the NSHA, she was a pediatric ER nurse. She says she was pulled into Safe Haven work through tragedy.
We had a 15-year-old that had checked into the ER and with abdominal pain. We did checked her vital signs and then put her back in the waiting room to wait for a room to go back to. She then delivered her baby in the bathroom in the emergency room and put him in the trash can. Maybe 10 to 15 minutes later, a housekeeper found him and we started life-saving efforts on a bathroom floor. Moving back into a room a little bit later, we were unsuccessful in saving his little life.
So close. He was in that hospital.
So close. It was a traumatic event for everyone. And
the baby's death affected her personally. 2 weeks before that baby was left in an ER bathroom trash can, Berner's own 15-year-old son and his teenage girlfriend delivered their baby boy. But Berner says initially, fear and shame kept her son and his girlfriend from coming forward with news of the pregnancy. The two kept their pregnancy a secret for weeks.
So it really hit home for me that this could have been our grandson had they not reached out, had they not received what they needed.
And Berner says their unconditional love and support was what her son and his girlfriend needed. Today, her grandson is 13 years old.
Thank the Lord, you know, because of all these different choices that those kids made, he's here and he's just amazing. He's one of the lights of our life for sure.
Still, Berner says she thinks often about that baby boy and the mother who left him in that ER bathroom trash can.
But as far as the women that I've helped, from 13 to 41, some of them have had master's degrees, some of them have been homeless. I think that it is across the board. College students at you know, major universities, and then folks that have been trafficked from one state to another. It is all across the board. So when we talk about who do we target, you target reproductive years, because that's really, truly, everyone needs to have that information.
As Berner and I prepare to part ways.
Oh my gosh, my friend, thank you very much. I would squeeze you, but we're in a car.
Yes.
One last question about the young pregnant woman who called the hotline that day.
Do you know how she came about knowing about the Safe Haven hotline? How did she?
She Googled it.
She Googled it. So I do my own Safe Haven search. Hey Google, find Safe Haven hotline.
According to Child Welfare Information Gateway.
Search results include a hotline definition, abuse response call center, a mental health hotline, help for the homeless, a suicide prevention line, and rounding out the list.
She's gonna walk directly up to the box. She's gonna open up the door. As soon as this door is opened up, one of the alarms is already going off.
Safe Haven with a box. That's the sound you make when you're a preschooler. Speed walking around a 15,000 square foot banquet hall with a 25 foot high ceiling.
Good evening, everyone.
It's 6 p.m. in Hobart, Indiana, a working class town about 30 miles southeast of Chicago. The small Midwestern city is the backdrop for the annual Safe Haven Baby Box Banquet. Monica Kelsey is the woman on stage extending the welcome to a mixed bag of guests trickling in.
I'll tell you, if you look around here tonight, you'll see some of those blessings running around, and we really don't get mad when they're running around. This is probably the only place that it's probably acceptable.
Men and women wearing sports coats, jeans, skirts, and hoodies. Every year, Kelsey brings together these Safe Haven Baby Box supporters. And yes, children who were placed in a box when they were only hours old.
For me, it's kind of seeing the fruits of our labor. You know, we work every day not knowing if we make a difference. You know, yes, a baby's placed in the box. Yes, sometimes we help moms. But when we come here, we've made families. I mean, these kids are here with their adoptive families. This is a family now. We've made families with these kids. And then we also get to have an impression on these kids. I don't want them growing up thinking they're worthless. I don't want them ever questioning their worth. I want them to know their worth, and every time that we get together, we celebrate you because you are.
That's how 50-year-old Kelsey says she grew up, loved and celebrated. Kelsey is petite with glasses and blonde streaked bangs. We find a quiet corner of the banquet hall to talk. She reminisces about growing up in Paulding County, Ohio, a small community on the Indiana border.
So, you know, my parents did a really good job when I was adopted because it was so normal for me. My older sister is Mexican, I'm dark-complected, and then my younger sister's blonde hair, blue eyes. And so from the outside looking in, everybody knew we were adopted, but they just made us feel so special. And so when I would go to school, you know, and people would say, you know, like, oh, you're adopted? And I'll be like, and you're not? Like, it was
Kelsey says growing up, she was told her birth parents were young and in love, but couldn't care for her, so they placed her for adoption.
And that is the story that they were told when they adopted me. And so my whole life growing up, I thought I had a fairy tale family waiting for me when I would turn 18 and my birth records would be open and these people would just welcome me with open arms. And it was quite the shock to learn that there was no truth to that story.
Kelsey was 37 years old when she met her biological mother in Michigan. It was 2010.
That truly became the best and the worst day of my life because I got to meet the woman who I had fantasized about for many, many years. Very fair skin, blonde hair, blue eyes, 4'11", 100 pounds soaking wet, and I didn't look a thing like her. And so as I'm sitting in her living room holding my husband's hand, the story, you know, comes up of my adoption. And I wanted to know who my biological father was, because it was kind of the elephant in the room.
After 3 hours, she says she finally conjured up the nerve to ask about him.
Who is my biological father? I wanted to meet him. And she got up and she walked in her bedroom and she grabbed this blue folder that was tattered and it was torn and you could tell it was very aged. And she sits down on her chair and I'm sitting on her love seat and she pulls out a police report from August of 1972. She was 17 years old. She was brutally attacked and raped and left along the side of the road. And
Kelsey's birth mother pressed charges against the man who attacked her. He was arrested.
When her life was finally getting back to some normalcy, she finds out she's pregnant.
It was 1972. Abortion was still illegal, even in cases of rape. But Kelsey says her birth mother was advised to have a back alley abortion.
Actually, it was my birth grandmother that took her to a back alley abortion facility. They paid $75, which back in that day, that was a lot of money. And my birth grandmother was so upset because she didn't go through with it. And I actually asked her, I said, why didn't you? And she said that there was blood on the table and on the floor. And she said it was just disgusting. And she says, I just felt like I was doing something wrong.
Kelsey's birth mother was hidden for the rest of her pregnancy. She gave birth in a hospital in April of 1973. 2 hours after Kelsey was born, her birth mother vanished. While hospitals today are designated safe haven locations, they weren't 50 years ago. In 1973, Kelsey was considered a border baby, an infant or young child abandoned or orphaned and left in a hospital.
I remember sitting there thinking, this is a sad story. Like, I am so sorry for you. Like, this is horrible. Not comprehending that not only was she telling me her story, but she was telling me mine.
It's a story, Kelsey says, she initially refused to believe.
No, I just kept going back to, this is not what my parents told me, that maybe this isn't my biological mother, you know, and it was, I just didn't want that part to be my life. But I became an expert investigator because I was set to prove her story wrong. And what I proved was she was telling me the truth.
Kelsey and her birth mother had 3 years together before she died at the age of 57 in 2013.
She had no more children after me. And so getting to know her, I became her daughter. And the day she died, I was actually sitting beside her in a hospital room holding her hand when she took her last breath. You know, and people are like, aren't you mad at her because she, you know, she abandoned you? And it's like, no. The circumstances that she went through, who could blame her? You know, and so I think meeting her and learning how bad it was gave me the empathy that I needed to do this today.
And what about your biological father?
I have never met him. I've spoken to him on the phone. And he truly is not part of my story, you know? I don't know my ethnicity, but I'm still a human being and I still have value, and my life isn't worth less simply because of the way I was conceived. And I didn't deserve the death penalty for the crime of my biological father.
With the missing blanks of her life now filled, Kelsey says she found herself with an identity crisis.
Being conceived in rape and having to find my worth, because I struggled with worth. I struggled with worth a lot because I felt like I was that poster child for an unwanted child in America. Plus, I was a medic and a firefighter. And so at 37, I buried myself in my work. I felt like saving more people on the back of an ambulance gave me worth. And I had to truly kind of go back to my faith and my family and find my worth again, because my worth isn't in people. You know, my worth comes from far deeper.
She says, surprisingly, she found encouragement in a senatorial hopeful.
And more political news this morning. A Midwest Republican has reignited the firestorm over rape and pregnancy. Originally,
during this time, in Indiana, there was a person running for U.S. Senate named Richard Murdoch.
Now, during a debate with his opponent last night, Indiana Senate hopeful Richard Murdoch was asked whether abortion should be allowed in cases of rape or incest.
I struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize life is that gift from God. And I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
His words, they were taken out of context is what they were. And so the pro-abortion people just hammered him. And I'm sitting, you know, in my home going, he's defending my life.
Richard Murdoch's courageous response set in motion a series of events that eventually led to the founding of Kelsey's nonprofit organization, Safe Haven Baby Boxes. After Murdoch's debate, Kelsey gave an interview to a local television station about the impact of his words on her life.
And I met this woman named Pam Stenzel, who was also conceived in rape. And so she's standing there and we're like talking to each other and we just clicked, like sisters clicked.
Pam Stenzel, a seminary-trained psychologist, also ran pregnancy care centers in Florida, and she was a public speaker.
She called me and she goes, hey, I'm going to South Africa. Do you want to come? Who in their right mind is going to say no to that, you know?
During the 2013 trip, the two crisscrossed South Africa. The last leg of their trip was at a church in Cape Town. While there, Kelsey noticed what looked like a mailbox in a wall. Church members told her it was a baby safe.
And this baby safe was the only one in Cape Town. And it was at a church. There, how many hundreds of churches? And I happened to be speaking at the church that had the baby safe. And I was like, okay, I need more info here. And they said, well, women bring their babies here at night. And it calls the pastor's cell phone. And I'm like, and he just answers the phone? Like, how does this work?
After answering the call, Kelsey says the pastor retrieved babies from the bassinet and church members later adopted the infants. Baby boxes aren't a new invention. The archaic concept has existed globally for centuries in nations like Germany, Austria, Poland, and Switzerland. Much like the baby safe in South Africa, the device in Japan is called a baby hatch. In South Korea, the concept of a baby box has been used since 2009.
And so I couldn't get this out of my mind. And I took some photos, and on the flight back from Cape Town, South Africa, on a Delta napkin, I hand drew my vision of the baby box.
On our next episode, good things come in small boxes.
And I said, hey, I want you to build me this. And he goes, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I'm going to save babies in fire stations. And he's like, have you lost your mind?
The baby was just born, so I had the umbilical cord on. They had it wrapped up in an old sweatshirt, you know, a little bit bloodied and that.
It was just, like, astonishing to me. One, she was dropped off in a box 2 to 3 miles up the road from our home. I had no idea this box existed.
This is Mia. Mia was surrendered at Chief Lucas's firehouse in their baby box in Seymour, Indiana, a little over 2 years ago. Here's Chief Lucas. You remember him?
Join us next week for part 2 of Safe Delivery, a production of World Radio.